The COVID pandemic is highlighting shocking patterns, revealing how this disease attacks men and women differently.
Men have about a 40% higher chance of dying compared to women.
40% is massive.
Leading me on a journey to investigate sex differences in health and medicine.
Wow. Is this known by the general public?
I don't think it's known.
What I discover is that even though women generally outlive men, there is a dangerous gender gap in data and the way women are treated.
Many of the drugs that we give, we have actually no idea how they function in women's bodies.
I learn how biases in diagnosis can be life-threatening.
I didn't realize how close I was to dying.
So when it comes to our health, how much does sex matter? And ultimately, are women the fitter sex?
Walking through a hospital corridor.
I'm Dr. Ronks, an emergency medicine doctor. Over the last year, hundreds of COVID patients have come through my hospital. And it's clear more men needed inpatient treatment for COVID-19 than women. It made me ask questions about gender, sex, and race, and made me want to investigate why some people are affected much worse than others.
A lake in London with the city skyline in the distance. Ronks in a grey suit, walking down a quiet residential street.
I'm meeting Anna and Danny, a young, active couple.
When we first heard about COVID, we weren't particularly concerned.
Early in the first wave, they both contracted the virus.
We'd both lost our taste buds and sense of smell. Whilst my symptoms plateaued and then sort of disappeared within a week, his got very serious very, very quickly. He seemed to just be getting worse and worse and worse.
Danny wearing an oxygen mask on March the 20th, 2020.
I felt that I was being attacked. My body was reacting to it, but couldn't fight it.
Hey there, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you.
Right, come on in.
Thank you, keep distance.
In the back garden.
Now, Danny, tell me about when you first realised that something wasn't right with your body.
So it was on a Friday in the middle of March. Mm-hmm. Wasn't really feeling so well. Aching bones, loss of taste.
Okay, and then what happened?
And that's when it started going downhill. Started developing a fever as well. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of it was the breathing, because that, in a way, was the game changer. And it's as if I was scuba diving, I'm underwater, and someone is little by little turning off that tank. And I'm just gasping for air. I can't get it in.
He just had nothing to give, no puff.
Are you either of you thinking, why did you both have different outcomes?
Yeah, we've been wondering it since the beginning.
Both Anna and I went through the same initial experience, yet Anna plateaued and started recovering, and I pretty much went off the cliff. Mm. So started thinking about, all right, is there a difference? Why did I get it worse than Anna did? Is there a difference between the sexes?
Anna and Danny aren't alone in wondering that. Anecdotally, men do seem to be hit harder, but is there actually data backing that up?
From the very beginning, I was interested in whether the virus was affecting men and women differently. You'd imagine that it would be one of the simplest things that you could collect on a medical record. But even so, we're finding that still a majority of countries are not telling us anything about whether it's men or women that have got COVID.
Ronks pays a visit to Professor Sarah Hawkes.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Ronks. How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you for inviting me to your home.
Come on in.
Sarah's organisation has been collecting available data to understand the global disease patterns.
We want to know, is it men getting infected or is it women getting infected?
Mm-hmm. If we look at the England data, what we see is that we've got slightly more cases confirmed amongst women in England. Mm-hmm. But if we look at deaths, we've got more deaths in men.
And it's very clearly
and
men
it's
as
very,
well.
Very, very clearly men.
15.50%.
The rate of men being admitted to intensive care compared to women is about double.
Really?
And men have about a 40% higher chance of dying compared to women.
So more men are dying.
And that pattern is repeated again and again across multiple countries.
A graph showing the death rate.
Across the world, more men are dying of COVID than women. And in England, men account for nearly 60% of all deaths.
I guess what we now need to find out, is this related to biology, so XY chromosomes XX, or is this more about gender and the behaviours within the social constructs that maybe influence their outcomes?
We can only ask those questions because we've got the sex disaggregated data that shows a difference. So, we, you know, data, it's not the sexiest thing in the world.
It's not the sexiest thing.
But it can be really powerful.
In the back of a car.
It feels a little bit ridiculous that we have all of this data that is related to sex and we aren't using them to discover whether some sexes, or male or females, do better with diseases. So much information, and it just feels like it's all out there, but nobody really cares. Or maybe there's just not money to interrogate it.
So why haven't we been looking at sex differences more closely? Professor Philip Golder uncovered sex differences in his work investigating HIV and has his own theory to why it's a little contentious.
You know, it's sort of a taboo subject in a way. It might be that there's a feeling to want to make out that people are equal, that there aren't any differences, and therefore to identify differences or suggest that there might be differences could be an unpopular thing to do. On the other hand, I think now that these differences are becoming very clear-cut with something like COVID, people are very interested.
Philip is conducting a study investigating our immune response to COVID. In both sexes, our immune system is divided into two parts, the innate and the adaptive. The innate response is our first line of defence. It's fast and untargeted. A fever is a sign it's working, raising the temperature to kill any potential enemies. If that fails, the slower adaptive response takes over with specialised antibodies and blood cells known as T cells. The question is, how and why do males and females respond differently to the same virus?
We invited Anna and Danny on the study because they were a special couple, a special family, in the sense that they were all exposed at the same time.
Philip's colleagues have been taking samples from both sexes to try and understand how their innate and adaptive responses differ.
One of the reasons we're really interested in studying you guys, you both, is that your disease outcome has been very different. And that's reflected across the whole kind of spectrum of people who've been infected by this virus.
The study will examine differences in Danny and Anna's T-cell and antibody responses. If Danny's are higher, it could mean that his first line of defence was weaker, so his adaptive immune response had to work harder.
Why haven't we been looking at the sex differences more before? I think, for example, in my field of work in HIV, it took something like 36 years since the epidemic started to realise that women have five times more chance of completely suppressing the virus through their immune response than men.
So if viral infections are hitting men more severely than women, it's worthwhile understanding what's different between the sexes. And the most fundamental thing are the X and Y chromosomes. Most human cells contain 23 pairs of chromosomes. The 23rd pair, the sex chromosomes, differ between males and females. Females have two X chromosomes and males have one X and one Y. Each X chromosome contains around 1,000 genes. The Y chromosome is smaller with less than 100.
Baltimore.
Professor Sabra Klein has been studying how this and other differences between males and females can impact how we fight viruses like COVID.
nice to meet you.
It is lovely to meet you.
We know that women tend to generate greater immune responses to viruses than do men. And high levels of estrogens have been associated with greater immunity in females. Many genes, over 60 genes that are very important for the functioning of our immune system, are located on the X chromosome. And researchers, including myself, are very interested in trying to better understand how these genes on the X chromosome may serve to protect females from things like viruses.
Wow, so when we think about our immune system, in terms of how effective it is, it's as basic as our chromosomes, XX and XY.
The simple answer is yes, but we do know that environmental factors as well as our hormones play distinct roles in contributing to male-female differences in the functioning of the immune system.
Thank you so much.
Sabra believes that the second X chromosome is a key reason why females have a better immune response to viruses.
I'm thinking, if our sex chromosomes play such an important role in immunity and disease progression, why has scientific research not looked more closely at this?
Are women the fitter sex? Are women the fitter sex?
Women outlive men worldwide by an average of 6 to 8 years. In the SARS and MERS outbreaks, death rates were 50% higher in men. But it's not just viral infections. Men are also more likely to develop diabetes. And cancer research shows that men are around 20% more likely to get cancer and up to 40% more likely to die from it.
Boston.
At the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Dr. Andy Lane has been investigating why more men die from cancer.
Tell me a bit about your research then.
So I'm a physician and a scientist, and I take care of patients with leukemia for most of my time in the clinic. Many of the diseases that I take care of, those patients have a slight bias toward there being more men than women. And it was assumed that it was because men did more risky behaviors than women, like they smoked more cigarettes, they drank more alcohol. And indeed, those things are cancer risk factors, and they do change perhaps the skew of cancer. But there are a few things that say that's not simply that.
Is the same difference seen amongst boys and girls?
In children, the two main most common cancers in children are brain tumors and leukemias. Both of those have a male bias. Now, it is not 2 or 3 to 1, but it's still 20 or 30% higher in males than in females. That means boys than in girls. And so infants are not working in the factory, being exposed to chemicals, smoking, etc. So that got us thinking that there might be something intrinsic to being a male or a female at the level of the cell, the DNA, or the organism that might be contributing. Obviously, females have two X chromosomes, males have one X and one Y, so of course there are going to be differences there.
Having two X chromosomes means double the amount of genetic information. For decades, we've understood that the body switches off one X chromosome in each cell, X inactivation. Scientists now know that up to a quarter of the genes on the X chromosome escape inactivation and remain turned on, providing a set of backup genes. Some of these genes could give females added protection to diseases like cancer.
In our study, we called them escape from X inactivation tumor suppressor genes. They have a normal function, and one of those functions is to prevent the cell from behaving like a cancer.
So in terms of your research, there is a relationship between genes that have escaped X inactivation and some cancers, and there is a gender bias.
And that's where the overall hypothesis of our work came. Female cells, by virtue of having the escape, essentially have extra protection, and that simply was a kind of a new idea that hadn't been looked at across all cancer types.
Wow. Is this known by the general public?
I don't think it's known. I don't think it's known by many physicians and scientists.
The fact that females may have a biological advantage when it comes to many cancers and diseases makes me think our bodies are fundamentally different. But perhaps that's not so surprising. After all, there are clear everyday examples.
If we think about alcohol, it's well known that women process alcohol differently from men. And a simple drug such as paracetamol. The recommended dose for men and women is exactly the same, but we know men clear paracetamol from the bloodstream 20% faster than women.
An animation comparing women to men.
Females process and metabolize alcohol and medicines differently to males, and it's not just because of their size. It's because they are biologically different. Women tend to have more body fat than men, where medicines can accumulate and linger. Their kidneys are also smaller, which means it takes longer for drugs to leave their system. Changing levels of female hormones also means that drugs can be processed differently over a menstrual cycle. In the past, women were routinely excluded from drug trials, partly to protect women's fertility, but also because fluctuating hormones meant women's results were often inconsistent and considered too complicated. So drug trials have historically used male cells, male mice, and male humans. This means most drugs on the market have been predominantly tested on men. But what's the situation today?
Guidelines for phase one clinical trials. So how to make a good trial. I'm looking for information about or guidance in regards to sex. Okay, so special populations. Women. The inclusion of women as early as possible in a drug development might be a valuable clinical strategy. I don't think it could be valuable. I think it's absolutely important.
Incredibly, even now in the UK, including females in clinical trials isn't a legal requirement. And shockingly, women are twice as likely as men to experience side effects to drugs and have more adverse reactions to vaccines. But the lack of females in clinical trials is only partly to blame. In his book on the genetic superiority of women, Sharon Moalem outlines why he believes women have more side effects when medicine is involved. Sharon, nice to meet you. Hello.
Likewise.
Even though women have this biological advantage, they're still being let down by medicine.
Many of the drugs that we give, we have actually no idea how they function in women's bodies.
This is really scary. It's really scary to hear. As someone who has XX chromosomes, there's a little bit of me that feels like, oh, like the whole population of men just don't care about women.
I don't think that there was some type of patriarchal conspiracy. In fact, I think it's the opposite. It was seen that men are a bit stronger and they didn't want to harm women's reproduction.
Do you feel that women are being included more in clinical trials now?
Yes. So what does that mean? So if we start out using male cells, male mice, and then at the end of the trial, we include both men and women, but not enough of them to get a meaningful result, it's like mixing red and white wine into a bowl together. You'll get rosé. And that's the way in which we have drugs approved.
Wow.
So in fact, by including women in clinical trials today, we have less information about the sex differential effects of the drug. That's why I'm arguing that why are we developing drugs for both sexes? Why don't we have two parallel systems? Why don't we use female cells, female animals, female test subjects, and then get drug approval for women and do the same thing for men? We might actually learn that some drugs may only work for one sex or another.
This is literally so fascinating.
If we're not going to take sex into account, then really we're not going to really be helping both sexes.
Does sex matter?
Nothing matters from the perspective of biology and medicine greater than sex.
Wow. What Sharon says makes perfect sense. If we metabolize drugs differently, for example, females respond up here and males respond down there, we mix that data together, but then it's not clear how each sex has responded. And so if we are going to include females in clinical trials, we need to be examining the data and dividing it by sex. Otherwise, we could be doing more harm than good.
Ronks is on a laptop.
And sometimes, even when we do know a drug will have adverse effects, the information doesn't get through to women. An example is a drug called sodium valproate that has been on the market since 1973. It's used mainly to treat epilepsy. Even though regulators have known about the dangers of this drug for decades, very few patients were told that it could damage unborn babies.
A blonde woman walking down a residential street in Preston.
Emma has epilepsy and has been taking sodium valproate since the age of 12. Her friend Janet has also taken the drug since her teens. When they decided to have children, each consulted with their doctor.
The consultants always advised that it would be okay to take it during pregnancy, there would be no risk to the baby, and that's what I did.
Photos of Emma with her children.
I've got 5 children, and they've all been diagnosed with fetal valproate spectrum disorder. There are many symptoms: autism, epilepsy, cerebral palsy, deafness, incontinence, neurodevelopmental delays, speech and language delay, a huge array.
Emma and Janet now know that these issues are all related to the sodium valproate that they each took in pregnancy.
They were poorly, they weren't developing. It couldn't just be my bad luck that this was happening. My sister phoned me one day and she was crying on the phone saying that she'd seen a lady appealing for women to come forward who had been on sodium valproate. That was a light bulb moment. It was that moment where everything I'd been saying to everyone's healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, family, that there was something wrong and no one believed what I was saying. Very hard, and just to speak to Janet, just to hear somebody that knew what I was going through, it was, never forget that moment. It saved my life, saved my children's life, because we've now got answers.
Janet Williams.
Since we met, we decided to start up this campaign and try and help and support other families and try and make a difference to ensure that these families are looked after the way that they should be, knowing full well that they weren't at the time.
They're members of the National Valproate Campaign. A red brick semi-detached house in Durham.
One family that has joined their campaign are Lisa, Robbie and their 9-year-old son Kieran. He's one of around 20,000 children that have been affected by sodium valproate since it came to market in 1973.
He knows he's different from other people. Other children notice he's different.
He struggles with writing, anything fine motor, speech. He's still struggling with sight, is improving. Yeah, he's got quite a lot.
It went a bit off.
But he's still special. We wouldn't have him any other way. At no point at all did they say you shouldn't be taking this drug if you're thinking about having a child in the future, or you shouldn't be, we could wean you off this drug, anything like that.
Kieran and Robbie are playing football.
I thought it was me. Have I been a bad mum, or am I fated to be like this? I think there'll always be an essence of guilt there.
Today, thanks to the campaigning of Janet and Emma, women taking sodium valproate are much more aware of the dangers.
So that's a big warning for women and girls that this medicine can seriously harm your unborn baby. I started to get these on my medication probably around 2019. It's something clear, and it's something there, and it's something you take note of. But there was nothing there, not a thing. How many families' lives wouldn't have been, not ruined, but upside down, just with a little symbol.
This symbol has finally given women the power to make informed choices. Emma and Janet tell me it took years of campaigning for their concerns to be heard.
It feels to me, and I'm pretty cross about this, that historically, women have not been listened to. Historically, women are seemingly being protected from making informed decisions about their bodies.
Absolutely. And we definitely feel it is, it's an institutional problem.
Absolutely. It is agreed that pregnant people on sodium valproate should be warned about this, but yeah, not yes. every pregnant person is. Is that no. is that what we're saying?
Yes, exactly. Yes. We know that there are families out there that still aren't being told about it. And I think that's what keeps us going. We know that there was 400 babies harmed by valproate last year.
Janet, Emma, you have done so much already. You have used kind of personal trauma to actually make changes to a medication. You're thinking about future children, and you really, really want women to have the autonomy to make decisions with correct information about their bodies and their future pregnancies. And I am humbled by you, but absolutely disgusted that it's taken this long.
Ronk strolls onto a canal bridge and leans against a railing, gazing out across the water.
The story of these families highlights many flaws within the system. And the biggest concern of them all is that women were not listened to and dismissed. Deliberate or unconscious, in the medical world, bias against women exists. And this can lead to serious consequences.
Are women the fitter sex? London.
It's obvious, but females are biologically different to males. But it goes way beyond drugs acting on the sexes differently. Women can also present differently to men for the same conditions. But because so much of medicine and healthcare is biased to men, these differences are often overlooked. You can see this bias in the diagnosis of autism. Scientists believe that thousands of women and girls are going undiagnosed. And part of the reason is that this condition is typically linked to boys and men.
Francesca, hi, I'm Dr. Ronks.
Hi, nice to see you, come on in.
Thank you. When I have watched TV programmes or met autistic people, they tend to always be men, male.
So we have this stereotype and it's perpetuated in research, actually. A lot of studies didn't even recruit females because they didn't expect to get enough. And that's a real problem because then that trickles down into what we know about autism, how we design the diagnostic systems and so on. So this male stereotype is a real problem. We know that some autistic women develop quite complex masking behaviour. So they've learned how to behave and they maybe watch a lot of films to try and learn how do I dress, how do I walk, what do I talk about, how do I start a conversation. Learning quite consciously and deliberately how to fit in.
How does the diagnostic tool that you use cater for this? I could imagine many young girls, many women will be able to fake it, for want of a better word.
It's a really important question. How do we adapt a diagnosis to be fair to women and girls? And at the moment, that hasn't really been done. We need to focus our research on them so that what we know about autism isn't just what we know about male autism.
Autistic women and girls often go undiagnosed, partly because they're able to mask or camouflage their autism. At Limpsfield Grange, a state school comprising mostly of autistic girls, their head teacher believes that early intervention is the key to accessing tailored support.
Miss Wild, hello!
Hi, lovely to meet you.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Parents who suspect that their children are autistic or their female child is autistic, what are the things that they've told you in terms of difficulties getting diagnosis?
They come up against lots and lots of barriers, and it's almost like autism isn't even on the list because you're female. Actually, it is about medical professionals and GPs in particular having an open mind and really hearing what people say.
It feels quite poignant to hear you say healthcare professionals need to be open-minded and learn to do better and be better. I'm 10 years out of medical school now, and still when anybody says the word autistic, autism to me, I have somebody lining up pencils or cars or being really intelligent, or I've got the really unruly, difficult to manage, non-verbal autistic boy. In my head, I definitely don't have an autistic woman or an autistic female child.
It's really about just people listening, and actually if you don't make the right call or you don't listen to all of the information, you're going to close down doors that you're not even thinking about.
And I guess we all come with our own biases, don't we? In our workplace, in our social life, etc. I feel even more worried that the biases that I hold would prevent a young person being able to access the care that they need, which could be life-changing.
Four female students file into the room.
Hi, everybody. Hi. Thanks for having me here.
I'm Amina and I'm 13.
I'm Scarlett and I'm 15.
My name is Layla and I'm 15.
I'm Sophie and I'm 12.
Are you able to tell me about when you were first told that you were autistic?
I was diagnosed formally when I was 3.
I think I was about 7 or 8.
I was in year 5 at my old mainstream primary school, and it was more of a relief to my parents because they were fighting so much to get my diagnosis.
I was 9 when I was diagnosed, and I remember, like, because my parents literally, like Scarlett, they've been fighting for like 2 years. Like, so hard.
You seem very, very confident and socialised. So, do you think that was part of the reason why your diagnosis came later?
I guess I was just really good at masking, which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But nowhere would believe that I was autistic.
And that is really something that us doctors need to realise, is that in girls, the way that autism traits and autism can present sometimes is just so subtle that we mistake it for something else.
Now, tell me how your life has changed being here.
I guess I know who myself is, and I know I'm not like the angry person I was when I was, like, before I was diagnosed.
Now that I'm here, I found girls who are just like me.
This school has honestly changed my life. I think it's created a person out of what I was at a mainstream school that I could never have done by myself.
The girls smile while walking through the school grounds with Sarah and Ronks. Alpacas in a paddock.
The alpacas are quite jittery and they're quite anxious, and so it's quite a good way of talking to the girls about, well, you have to be a bit calmer if you want to spend time with the alpacas.
Just seeing how this school supports autistic girls really emphasises how important early diagnosis is for their quality of life. The gender bias in autism, I don't think is deliberate, but definitely needs to be challenged. We need to be asking specific questions which pick up female autistic traits, and I guess as a society, we need to redefine our understanding of autistic women.
An NHS flag flying on a pole.
Gender bias exists everywhere. It prevents women and girls from getting help sooner, and in some conditions like heart disease, this delay can be a matter of life or death. We tend to think of heart attacks as a male problem, but it is the single biggest killer in women worldwide. For both sexes, crushing chest pain can be the main symptom. But as Dr. Canadian explains to me, women are more likely to present with a wider range of symptoms. In medical school, I just remember being taught that it's the, oh my God, you know, pale, sweaty, clutching chest. But in reality, that isn't always what we see.
The gender bias in heart disease is something that we have known about for a number of years now. So when a woman presents, or even if she's experiencing, she doesn't think that she could be having a heart problem herself.
One of Dr. Canadian's patients, 35-year-old Jenna, experienced this bias firsthand.
Jenna.
On TV, it seems to be portrayed as a man's problem. It's always the men that you see hit the floor, holding the arm. It's not very often you see women. I had no chest pains, no pain in the arm, nothing like that, no shortness of breath, nothing at all.
Walking her dog.
I felt like I had a little bit of heartburn. It felt like there was acid rising from here, like about here, up my throat, just to round my lower jaw. But it went as quick as it came. It started happening at least 3 or 4 times a day. So I thought, I think it's probably time I went and seen a doctor. The nurse examined us. She said you could hear a slight crackle on one of my lungs and gave us antibiotics. I thought I just had an infection.
A silver-rimmed wall clock.
I got an episode while I was in Asda and it lasted about 4 or 5 minutes. So I just stood still, leaning on the trolley, waiting for it to pass, continued doing my shopping. My sister ended up phoning an ambulance. When they came into my house, they just came in, introduced themselves, put the stuff down on the floor and said, right, come on, then we'll stick this ECG machine on you. And you could tell by his face when he looked at the results, he was like, yeah. And he took my husband into the passage and I could hear him saying, my wife's having a heart attack and if she's not in Freeman's within the next 30 minutes, she's not going to make it. Didn't realise how close I was to dying. Skinny, 35, walking, talking, but it nearly killed us. If it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody.
Dr. Canadian.
Jenna wasn't having a chest infection, she wasn't having indigestion, but she was actually having a full-blown heart attack. The important thing is that these atypical characteristics of the heart pain has been described more prevalent in women when compared to men. And that could be one of the reasons why women's symptoms are ignored.
That has shocked me. And then I think lots of doctors would then be thinking, I've seen loads of female patients with heart pain or chest pain or symptoms that I couldn't quite place. They were well, so I've sent them home. Maybe I should have sent them to the rapid access chest clinic or to have an angiogram sooner. Women are 50% more likely than men to receive the wrong initial diagnosis for a heart attack, and this can often be fatal. One diagnostic tool used is the coronary angiogram. It uses X-ray imaging and contrast dye to see if your heart's blood vessels are allowing blood through as they should. Most male heart attack patients show very clear blockages like this one. But this angiogram of a woman's heart reveals they often have a different cause.
What we see is that her arteries further down, they are very narrowed and some unusual appearances, particularly in that area. And that is a condition which happens more frequently in women than in men.
Women are more than twice as likely as men to have only partially blocked arteries. This means problems are harder to spot on an angiogram. From the patients to the families to healthcare professionals, the bias runs deep. And it's actually quite upsetting that only recently we've become aware of these sex differences. When women show different symptoms and healthcare professionals don't listen, women are harmed. This can be avoided. Things have got to change.
Are women the fitter sex? Are women the fitter sex?
It's now clear to me there's a data gap between the sexes. Information is missing about women's health and it's costing women their lives. But it doesn't stop there. I feel kind of embarrassed and ashamed that I haven't thought more openly about sex differences in lots of things. So being a feminist, I'm always thinking, this world is unequal, this world is designed for men, everything is for men, blah, 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 blah. But I've never actually sat down and thought, actually, in terms of health outcomes, and also just even broader in terms of how the world is designed, I've never really sat down and thought, is there data in regards to this? This gender data gap is something Caroline Criado Perez investigated in her best-selling book, Invisible Women. Caroline, hello.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, I'm good, thank you. Hello.
I just couldn't help myself. I was so horrified to discover that we were basing medical treatment and the development of drugs, just using male bodies, and that women were basically dying as a result, obviously not in every instance. And so we just don't notice when we're excluding women, because we're always talking gender neutrally, when most of the time we're actually talking about men. And then when women don't conform to that, they're screwed.
And that's the most frustrating thing for me, is that it does seem really, really, really obvious.
How can this be going on in the 21st century and it not be, you know, a front page news story every day? And that is because of the data gap. So in the allocation of government resources, in how we plan our economy, in public transport, in private transport, and you just see it crop up in all sorts of areas. The solution to the gender data gap is very, very simple. All you have to do is collect data on men and data on women, and then label it, and then analyse it separately.
Ronks nods in agreement. Nighttime.
I believe it's so important this data gap is filled. Understanding differences is going to help both sexes. It's what the Oxford team are trying to do with their COVID immunity study, the one Anna and Danny took part in. And now they've got the results. Hiya, Anna.
Hello.
Hey,
hi, good
evening.
Should we cut to the chase and tell you what the results
are?
Basically, you both have antibody responses.
Excellent.
However, the size of the responses was very different. And Danny's antibody levels are about 15 times higher than yours, Anna. And then the T-cell response is really, again, the same sort of pattern. So, and we know that females make stronger responses, innate immune responses to viruses and vaccines. If that innate immune response can block or deal with most of the virus, then the adaptive immune response has much less work to do to clear out the rest of it.
Her first line of defense is much stronger than, let's say, my first line of defense. So broke down my first line of defense, got into me, which is then why I had a lot more of the effect and a lot more, I guess, now of antibodies, where Anna was able to deflect it and still get some of it through, and I guess built up her immunity as well.
I think that's a good summary of it.
If we could understand why Anna's first line of defense is so strong, that information could be used to help someone like Danny, and perhaps prevent him ending up in hospital or worse. This could have massive implications for prevention through vaccines and for treatment that together could save many lives.
The more information we have, the more sex disaggregated data we have, the better it will be for both sexes when it comes to thinking about health, when it comes to thinking about vaccinations, medicines, basically, we can't treat each other as though we are one sex.
It's taken something as awful as a global pandemic for us to finally start seeing this. Many individuals in the scientific community have been pushing for this, and it feels as though that they are slowly starting to be heard.
Flowers in the countryside.
As are Emma and Janet and the thousands of families affected by the drug sodium valproate. A long-awaited review led by Baroness Cumberledge is aired on national TV.
If this government and the healthcare system ignores our review and another medication, a medical device, damages people to the extent that we have witnessed, they will and should not be forgiven. Sodium valproate is an effective medication to control epilepsy. But even today, this medication causes harm to unborn children.
Emma and Janet. Then Lisa sitting next to Kieran.
Women told us that when they were pregnant and controlling their epilepsy with sodium valproate, they were never told that the unborn baby could be seriously damaged. They didn't know that the chances were 1 in 2. 1 in 2 damaged babies. What a tragedy.
Emma takes off her glasses to wipe away her tears.
It's a vindication that we were right. You know, it's been worth every fight, every tear, every late night. And to hear that, to see that, it's been worth every moment. We've got to continue the campaign because children's lives depend on this now.
The aim for us now, as a family, is to make sure that no families have to go through all this again, that women get an informed choice, that they know the risks, the full risks, and then, obviously, we want care plans for our children. We can't be around forever.
Lisa's watching Kieran and Robbie play football in the garden. People coming and going from a hospital, then Ronks in front of it, wearing blue scrubs and a red lanyard.
What's become really clear to me is that there is a value in studying sex differences. The key to protecting us equally could in fact be found in treating us differently. As doctors, we're gatekeepers. We must be aware of our biases. We must also be aware that every decision we make affects people's lives. So does sex really matter? Definitely.